An announcement on Saudi Arabian television. The Arab state, one of four, severing their ties with Qatar on Monday. Saudi, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain accusing their neighbour of supporting terrorism and meddling in their internal affairs. Yemen and Libya's eastern-based government quickly following suit. The announcement closing transport ties with Qatar. The three Gulf states giving Qatari visitors and residents 2 weeks to leave. Saudi Arabia also seeming to reference Qatar's influential state-owned satellite TV channel, Al Jazeera, claiming the country broadcasts militant groups' ideology.
And I wanted to start with the Fed's dual mandate. We know it includes maximum employment and price stability. And focus on inflation here, because the Fed's been targeting 2% inflation since about forever. And under Greenspan, it averaged 2.5%. Now, under Bernanke, inflation slowed down to an average 1.9%. And this last section right here is Janet Yellen. Since February 2014, inflation has averaged 1.1%.
Why should people buy HomePod over Amazon Echo or Google Home at this price?
Well, what we've tried to do is build something that is a breakthrough speaker first. And so music is deep in our DNA, you know, dating back from iTunes and iPod. And so we wanted something that, number one, sounded unbelievable. And I think when people listen to it, they're going to be shocked over the quality of the sound.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's June 6, 2017, 5:12 in the morning. Glad to have you here for another business day, another edition of The Opening Bell. Lots to cover this morning. We'll get to the markets in a second, but yesterday was the 36th anniversary, 36 years since HIV was identified. It happened on June 5th, 1981. And in the years since, a lot has been done in terms of treating folks with HIV and fighting the disease itself. A little later in the program, we're going to take a snapshot of it and tell you exactly how that fight is being waged, where, and what it is meaning to you as well. In a little bit, we'll bring in our first guest, too. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning, Dow futures are pointing toward negative open later on Wall Street, off 23 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are lower as well. Crude oil is trading at $47.32 a barrel this morning, off almost a quarter of a percent. Asian stocks were mostly lower following a drop on Wall Street. Investors looking toward British elections later this week. General elections set for Thursday in Great Britain, although the campaign has paused for just a brief time after the aftermath of the deadly terrorist attacks in the London Bridge area. On Wall Street yesterday, Standard & Poor's index fell about 3 points. The Dow Jones lost about 22. The NASDAQ slipped 10. The dollar weakened against the yen and gained against the euro. In Europe this morning, most of the markets generally are lower, with the FTSE in London off about 4, the DAX off about 63, the CAC off about 15 points. Again, in this country, looking for a weak open later on Wall Street. A couple of stories we've been watching for you. Governor Jerry Brown of California predicting that President Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord will prove temporary because of the urgency of the issue. Brown telling the Associated Press on the sidelines of clean energy, a clean energy conference in Beijing, that China, Europe, and U.S. state governors will now fill the gap created by the vacuum of leaving the Paris Accord. You heard there in the opening montage, Apple is hoping a new smart home speaker will strike a chord with music lovers, the latest test of the iPhone maker's ability to redefine markets originally staked out by its rivals. The move announced yesterday escalates Apple's technological battle with Amazon and Google, as well as Microsoft. The giants are battling over still emerging fields that are expected to turn into technological gold mines, much in the personal way of computers and smartphones, how those became money-making machines in previous decades. For people with disabilities, finding independence can be a struggle, sometimes a major struggle. It impacts home life, finding a job, and more. For one Chicago-area woman, a trusted service dogs have helped in the search for independence. Social worker Amy Shally is quadriplegic with cerebral palsy. She's written a book about it called Making Independence Happen, One Paw at a Time. And Amy is with us this morning via Skype here on The Opening Bell.
Amy, welcome to The Opening Bell. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you too, Steve. Thanks for the interest.
So tell me about the book that you've written here and why you've done it.
So I wrote a book called Making Independence Happen One Paw at a Time. For short, I call it Making Independence Happen. And the reason why I wrote it, well, I kind of started feeling like I was being pulled in that direction. Kind of, God was kind of giving me some signals. You know, you're having a tough time finding a job. You need to get your story out there as a way to kind of encourage other people that might be going through similar circumstances. So that's when I started writing it, was kind of for that reason. I've always kind of struggled to find my place in this world as a person with a disability, and I just wanted to give some other people hope. But then also, my previous service dog, around April of 2014, his cancer started a reoccurrence, and I knew he probably wasn't going to make it. So I wanted to write the book as kind of a way to always have him with me. Because he actually, the first part of the book is written from a dog's point of view. And the second part of the book is written from my point of view as living my life as a person with a disability.
Why do you think it was important to tell the story from your dog's point of view? His name's Yazin, right?
Yes, his name was Yazin, and I just did that just to kind of make it more unique and more interesting for my readers, because I initially wrote the book for kids who were fifth grade on up, so like 9, 10 years old. And I figured they'd be more interested if they could read a story from a service dog's point of view.
And why is that? What is it that your dog says in this book that is important for people to hear?
Well, he goes through all of his life. So he starts out talking about how his parents were born to be breeders for a very special organization that is close to my heart called Canine Companions for Independence. And kind of their purpose in life was to bring dogs in the world, and he was one of those dogs. So he just goes through everything about his life, from being a puppy and living with his puppy raiser, and talking about some of the things he goes through. And then he talks about his experiences in advanced training, and then kind of his experiences meeting me and going through what they call a team training with me. So it was just more of a way for me to get the readers interested in what I was writing, I think.
What is it you think would surprise folks? What part of the story does he tell that will surprise folks?
I think they'll be surprised to learn that he, in addition to helping me and doing a really good job and a really fantastic job helping me and being a part of my life, service dogs also get the chance to just be dogs. And he went on some vacations with me, got to play with some other dogs. He loved to play fetch when he wasn't working. My current dog doesn't like to play fetch and doesn't like the water, which is kind of atypical for Labradors and Golden Retriever crosses. But Yazin loved his time playing fetch. I used to joke that that's how I thought I was going to find him dead someday, because he would just play it until really thought he would drop dead. He couldn't get enough of it, and it was his way of kind of being a dog after a long day's work. People, when I go and do author talks about my book and I share a little bit about my life as a person with a disability, and that is the one thing I think people are always, like, surprised to find out that they do get time to be just a dog. There, sometimes people feel sorry for working dogs because they think that their life is all about work. Well, it's not. And they, even when they're working, they're having fun. And I know that because their tail is always wagging and they like to make me happy. Sometimes even when they can't figure out what I want, they go and, you know, bring what they think I want just to try and make me happy.
You talked earlier about the struggles that you've been going through. I wonder if you could give our listeners a sense of why Yazin and now Portland are important to you being able to go out and get a job and live a normal life, as it were.
So I have what's known as spastic quadriplegia cerebral palsy. It's a condition that I was diagnosed with at a year old. Doctors believe that I had a stroke shortly after birth, and that's what caused me to be primarily in a wheelchair. I use a power wheelchair now in my everyday life, but I can walk with a walker as well. And Portland and Yazin both, they just help make me more independent. Like, when I go to work, they can help me open doors that I may not be able to open by myself. They can pick up things that I drop without putting holes in it or without causing damage to what they go to pick up. So he does the things for me that I would normally have to ask people to do if he wasn't with me. And it just gives me a greater sense of independence. And as a result of having Yazin and now Portland, I'm able to stay at home by myself during the day, which is something that may not be as easily or comfortably done if I didn't have a dog with me. Because right now I'm unemployed. So I spend a lot of my time at home.
What are the challenges when you're out looking for work? How do employers react? And why are you having a difficulty?
So I graduated with a master's degree in social work. When it came to finding employment, it's been very difficult because on job applications, one of the things that they'll ask you right away for any job that you apply for, social work or not, is if you have a valid driver's license and proof of insurance. And unfortunately, one of the things that I am unable to change as a result of my disability is the fact that I cannot drive a car. So that oftentimes doesn't even get my application looked at because of that reason.
Has having a service dog ever been a problem, or is that generally seen as a positive?
That is generally seen as a positive. Honestly, Steve, the good thing about me having a service dog is that service dogs are protected a little bit more under the ADA than maybe some of these other issues. So employers are usually very good about me having a service dog. When I was working as a social worker, it was never an issue because I always let them know in the interviews that I do have a service dog, that he will be coming with me. And then I have a letter that I take to my job the first time I'm hired that explains to everyone on my caseload what the dog is, why I have the dog, what the rules are as far as interacting with a service dog. And then I tell them that my door is always open should they have any concerns with allergies or fears of dogs, to please let me know and I will make other arrangements in order for me to both have my dog there with me and also still be able to perform the duties of my job.
So with the personal challenges that you've experienced in your life, back to the call, your calling as a motivational speaker, there's audiences out there who probably need to hear stories like yours, because they're probably going through the same thing, aren't they?
I would hope so. And I would hope that even if they aren't going through the same thing, even if they're going through a situation that's somewhat different, I would hope that when I do these author talks or, you know, some of the other opportunities that I've been given to do, I would hope that even people who aren't disabled are somewhat encouraged by me, because honestly, I am not going to let these challenges stop me. I'm going to find a way to keep going and keep, you know, persevering, because it's something that I feel God has called me to, and I know that if it's something that I'm supposed to do, then a way will be made for me to do it. And that's kind of why I got involved in writing the book too, because people, when I do these motivational talks, they often ask me, so Amy, do you ever wish that you weren't in a chair? Or do you ever wish that you could walk? Of course, you know, my answer is yes, but I also wholeheartedly believe that God is gonna use me to do some good with the body that I'm currently in and in the situation that I'm currently in.
Your partner there, Portland, he's as much as a physical asset to you as an emotional asset, I'm guessing, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He kind of keeps me going when I get down, but he is actually so silly and has quite a personality that it's hard to get down a lot when I'm around him, because he makes sure that I'm always laughing and stuff like that. So he kind of keeps me going too.
So who would your audiences be for the motivational speaking? You've talked about people who may be like you, but are you talking about maybe talking with employers and companies and all kinds of audiences?
Yes, I can speak to topics of, you know, using person-first language when you're dealing with individuals who have special needs. I have done one or two public speaking engagements on that topic, and it was very well received. I can also speak to just in terms of diversity and acceptance and things of that nature. And I can also speak to anti-bullying topics, because when I was first going through school, I had some situations with my peers where I had to deal with some bullying and some situations that were not always fun to deal with. So, and I feel like I'm equipped to talk about how to handle bullying, because I've not only been through it, but I'm also a social worker. So my background as a social worker could help that too.
How do people find your book and how could they get in touch with you?
Well, they can get in touch with me on my website, which is just amychelly.com. But they can also find my book on Amazon and Barnes and Noble online. It's online only right now, unfortunately, because I'm a self-published author. I went through CreateSpace, so a lot of bookstores and like Barnes and Noble don't want to carry my book in the stores. So, but they can find it online, and they can also purchase signed copies through my website as well.
Well, Amy, thanks for the inspiration and best of luck to you and Portland.
Thank you.
Amy Shalley is a social worker and also the author of Making Independence Happen One Paw at a Time. We're going to continue our conversation with Amy after the bell and post the full interview with the podcast of The Opening Bell at WGNradio.com. You can find her book and more information at amyshalley.com. That's C-H-A-L-L-Y.com and at Amy Shalley Author on Twitter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. It's 5:40 on Monday, the Ryan White HIV AIDS program. RWHAP commemorated HIV Long-Term Survivors Day this year, marking two important milestones. 36 years since HIV was first identified, June 5th, 1981, and 21 years since the highly active antiretroviral therapy became available in the U.S. Dr. Laura Cheever is a doctor and associate administrator at the HIV/AIDS Bureau at the Health Resources and Services Administration. She's with us this morning here on The Opening Bell to talk more about this. Good morning, Dr. Cheevers. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It's good to have you on because yesterday was a big day. Tell us what the anniversary was.
Yeah, so June 5th, we celebrate HIV National Long-Term Survivor Day. It really marks 36 years since HIV was first identified on June 5th, 1981.
It's hard to believe 36 years have gone by. What has happened in that time frame? If you had to give us a quick status of where things stand in not only the fight against HIV, but surviving it.
Yes. Yeah, so the first thing is in the early 1980s, to be diagnosed with HIV was a death sentence. People had a very short survival from the time they were diagnosed with AIDS. In 1995, for the first time, we really had highly effective antiretroviral drugs in this country. And today, if people get into regular medical care, they need to be diagnosed with HIV, be put on medications and stay on their medications, they can live a near normal lifespan. And the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program, which I work for in the federal government, really funds that access to care and treatment for over half of all the people diagnosed in this country.
And remind us again, Ryan White, that name, everybody should know it, but if they don't.
Yeah, so Ryan White was really one of my heroes. He was a young boy that was diagnosed with HIV in his early teen years. And he told his mother at that time, this was before we had highly active drugs, that he wanted to be able to go to school. And the people in the school did not want him there. They were misinformed about HIV. They thought he could spread it. And they really denied his ability to go to school. So he spent the rest of his life really advocating for all of people living with HIV that they should be treated humanely. And in the context of the danger that HIV risks exist, which is that they're not going to be able to get it from someone sitting in their classroom.
And here, all of these years later, we're seeing statistics that show a couple of things. First, one of them that jumps off the page is that 42% of your clients are 50 years and older. Now, that might seem like something going wrong with an aging population for those of us who understand that. That's people living long with AIDS.
Exactly, yes. And that's why we celebrated that HIV Long-Term Survivor Day, is that with appropriate care and treatment, people can live near normal lifespans with HIV, but it means that people need to get tested, to get into care, and to get on medicines and stay on those medicines.
Those medicines, too, how have they progressed over the years, the antiviral medications?
That's a great question. So in the late 1990s, when we first had highly active antiretrovirals, they were quite complicated. People commonly had to take multiple medications on a daily basis, some with food, some without foods, and really live their lives around trying to get their medications in, and those medications had lots of side effects. Today, someone diagnosed with HIV can only need to take one pill once a day, and those pills really have limited or no side effects. So it's a completely different story for people that are living with HIV today.
And I remember when these first hit the market, they were very expensive, and sort of an entire class of people almost were sort of shut out from receiving them. How has that changed?
Yeah, well, the Ryan White HIV AIDS program is a federal program that is funded specifically to address that. So the program that I work for here in Washington, D.C., provides funding to cities and states to support people who are living at the federal poverty line, more or less, to make sure that they do have access to medications. Over half of all the people that are on treatment in this country receive some support from the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program, so we fill a critical gap. So no one in your listening audience should be concerned that because they don't have insurance or because they don't have enough money, they don't have access to their medication. The Ryan White program can really help them fill in those gaps.
And how has the stigma changed, too? Is it different than it was 36 years ago, 26 years ago, 16 years ago?
So I wish I was more optimistic about that. So I think stigma has improved to some extent because people do live near normal lifespans, but there's still a tremendous amount of stigma about having HIV in this country. Over time, issues around homophobia have really changed some of those attitudes, but attitudes about HIV have changed less. And so a lot of people don't want to get diagnosed or don't want to seek help for their HIV because they don't want to disclose their infection to those people around them. It's a major barrier to care in this country.
And, that, you know, sort of along those lines, if you could talk to us a little bit about the demographics and the different sort of statistics of people who are contracting HIV. Are they gay? Are they straight? Are they people who've had other diseases? How would you describe it?
Yeah, so in this country today, sexual transmission is the leading cause of HIV transmission, and most of that is around gay men, particularly gay men of color. So that is a major factor. As well, right now we have an opiate crisis in this country, which I'm sure your listeners have heard about in a variety of different ways. But if people are injecting drugs, there's definitely a risk of transmitting HIV as well. So we worry that that is going to start to increase significantly. It hasn't really to date, but we're concerned about that.
Why are the numbers so high in terms of black community, the black community?
Yeah, so that's a really complicated question. I think there have been lots of studies that show that African Americans do not engage in significantly higher risks than their white counterparts. But there are lots of diseases that impact African Americans more severely, or they have worse health outcomes, including things like diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. So I think it's part of that trend across the nation around really a disproportionate risk of disease falling among people that are poor and of color.
How are young people responding to this? I know here in Chicago, we spoke recently with the Howard Brown Group and also Northwestern University. They're concerned that young people sort of have no knowledge of any of what you and I have just been talking about. They're so young that they don't know that history. And so they're practicing unsafe sex. They're doing all of those dangerous practices. What are you finding in that area?
Yeah, so I've got to say that I think that's exactly right, that we do see HIV rates are particularly high in the 25 to 34-year-olds in terms of new infection rates, and particularly among gay men. I think there is a sense, too, of complacency that, oh, HIV is a treatable disease. It doesn't matter if I get it. And with all the different things I'm trying to balance in my life, I don't need to particularly worry about that. I'm concerned because we really don't know which interventions are best. What can we do from a public health policy perspective? What interventions should we have addressing that lack of understanding among young people or lack of concern? And I think that we really do need to figure out how to interact with young people better to get them to better understand the risks involved.
How concerned are you, Doctor, with the financing of all of this? In recent weeks, we've been reporting on our program here about the president's budget proposal and efforts to cut. How would all of those cuts impact your programs?
So I think in terms of the president's budget, he really invests in programs that are providing direct healthcare services to individuals. So in terms of the F-18 budget, which the president just released a week or so ago, the parts of our program that are providing direct services to people, medications and medical treatment, are maintained. They're stable. So we've not seen any significant cuts there.
The actual survivors of HIV and AIDS, they have feelings today of, hey, I'm surviving. Are they happy? Are they concerned, optimistic going forward?
Yeah, so I think that for many of those people, it has been a complicated life in the sense that I was practicing HIV in the early 90s in San Francisco, and, you know, people would lose most of their friends, you know, would die of HIV. So those surviving had a lot of guilt about it. But I think today it is very much a new era, and people are surviving and doing exceedingly well. If we look in terms of just how people do medically in our program, people who are over 50 actually have better viral suppression rates than people under 50. They're better able to take care of themselves. They're at a different point in their life. But now they also are getting other diseases. So just like anyone who gets to be 50, 60, and 70, they're getting hypertension, diabetes, all those other complicated medical problems. So it's not just about having HIV anymore. It's about having HIV and growing old with HIV. And they're really the first people to do that in a significant number. So we in the Ryan White HIV AIDS program are definitely looking at how we can better serve all of those needs of those individuals who are living with HIV and other chronic illnesses that are related to aging.
Doctor, thank you for your work, and thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Laura Cheever is a physician and associate administrator for the HIV/AIDS Bureau at Health Resources and Services Administration.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. Dow futures are off 31 points. S&P and NASDAQ futures are lower. Gold and silver is trading higher. Now, the latest in agriculture and commodities. Here's Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. A lot of activity outside the trading halls at the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange yesterday, but a quick look at the grain market. Fractional changes only by the close in the grain market. At the Mercantile Exchange, hog futures lower. Cattle futures, again, higher. The nearby June contract up $1.70 a hundredweight. And the weekly crop bulletin issued yesterday afternoon says 96% of the nation's corn acres have been planted as of Sunday, and conditions of the corn crop are, well, in the good to excellent category, 68%. Soybean crop, 83% planted nationally. But now let's look at the other activity yesterday. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue traveled to Canada to meet with the Canadian Agriculture Minister Lawrence McAuley in Toronto. And in that meeting, the U.S. asked Canada to eliminate a new, quote, underhanded, quote, dairy pricing class that has undercut sales by U.S. dairies to Canadian processors. And then the other big story, Elk Point, South Dakota. The trial got underway yesterday between Beef Processors, Inc. and ABC News. It's going to be an interesting one to watch, a $5.7 billion lawsuit that says ABC was not truthful in its coverage of the pink slime story. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Tuesday, June 6, 2017. The Labor Department will release job openings and labor turnover information at for April. The Business Roundtable publishes its quarterly CEO Economic Outlook Survey, providing a forward-looking view of the U.S. economy. That's by asking its CEOs in a roundtable about what they're thinking. General Motors annual meeting of shareholders for the car maker and the owner of Chevrolet, Cadillac, Buick, GMC, and others. Today, they will vote on the company's remuneration report and the reappointment of the company's board, including the CEO, Mary Barra. Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference continues in San Jose. Kantar Millard Brown publishes its annual Brand Z ranking of the top 100 most valuable global brands as measured by their dollar value. Last year, Google and Apple, Microsoft were in the top three. Earnings today, Land's End and Dave and Buster's. Some of the things that could move the markets on this Tuesday, June 6, 2017.